am pleased to have back on the show Dr. Andrew Campbell. I believe I interviewed Dr. Campbell in the 90s when we were talking about silicone toxicity. He was the co-editor of a journal, I believe it was the International Journal on Toxicology. He'll tell us the exact title in a minute. Anyway, I'm having him back today to talk about toxic mold and how people can get exposed to mold, and if they have certain genetic predispositions, how that can be a real problem. Or even if they don't have those genetic predispositions, they have problems nonetheless. Welcome, Dr. Campbell. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on board today.
So you're calling from Texas today, is that right?
Houston, Texas.
Great. Yeah, I went to school in San Antonio and spent some time in Houston. I guess we can start with your role in defining some of the dangers in silicone to get a little background on the scope of your practice, because you're really you're concerned with all aspects of environmental medicine. Is that right?
Yes, in particular the aspects of toxicity. And how these toxins affect people. And I started with silicone. I published, I think it was 5 or 10 papers back in the early 90s on silicone, and then, of course, it became a prominent health problem, and it seems to be rearing its head again from the latest scandal from silicone manufacturer in France.
Right. And those implants are all over the world.
Yes.
Other than the U.S., although we have people here with them because they got them overseas.
And so, therefore, as you are well aware, there's a lot of problems with silicone breast implants as well as silicone other types of implants, chin implants, joint implants, et cetera, that are made with silicone. Even the solid silicone implants can be hazardous to health. One of the things that happened is that during the time of silicone breast implants, many plastic surgeons noticed that when they would go into surgery to remove one breast implant because it had ruptured, they would usually remove both and put new ones into both, and they'd see that the unruptured implant, the intact implant, had coloration in it, things floating about, or it wasn't a kind of icy blue color. It was more of a brownish black color, etc. So they did studies, these plastic surgeons, and found that this was due to molds, and that molds grew inside these implants. So back in the early 1980s, 1982, they published several studies showing that. Now, that's a long time ago. That's 30 years ago.
Right.
But women who had their implants removed still did not feel well, and when they came to see me, I tested them for mold, and many of them did have mold. And so when I treated them for the mold problem after the silicone issue, then they improved dramatically, and that's how I got involved in molds starting in the mid-90s.
That's how I got involved in mold, too, because I recognized that there were really three kinds of toxicity. One, the silicone toxicity was actually the most deadly. If you had a certain HLA type, it would often even kill you. You develop real severe autoimmune disease. One of my patients, who was a physician, was diagnosed with 6 autoimmune diseases within a couple of months of getting silicone implants. And these implants weren't ruptured. They were just simply, she was exposed to the silicone shell. Probably the same thing would have happened if she got a chin implant. So, you know, there's just a deadly disease in some people. And then there's what I call chemical toxicity, with silicone being one of those chemicals, but there's a huge number of chemicals in the gel, and even in the shells, even platinum is still leaking out at small amounts from many of the implants that are on the market today. So we have chemical toxicity with, again, silicone being one of the chemicals, but it's interacting differently with the body because of the genetic type. And people like me who had fibromyalgia tendency, I had fibromyalgia before I got implants when I overdosed myself with antibiotics and didn't take antifungals. That means I have the genetic type that can't get rid of mold biotoxins. So people like me who get breast implants don't do very well because unless we treat the mold and keep the mold levels down. And I've been able to do that by, you know, intermittent antifungals. And I tell all my patients, of course, a lot of them don't really get it, but they really can't take antibiotics unless they take antifungals. And then the third toxicity is just a pure biotoxin. And it's more with the saline implants. And it's just mold growing in the implants. And we have labs we send it off to, and they say it's mold. And an interesting story that that I shared on the program before, I'm not sure if I shared it with you, I had a patient who was allergic to penicillin, and every time somebody squeezed her real hard, she'd get an anaphylactic reaction, and she had penicillamine in her breast implants. So that just goes to show the danger of some of these molds, especially if you have allergies.
Yes, and the toxicity ranges from, as you put it, from occasional problems to very, very severe, life-threatening, and sometimes lethal problems, depending on, well, one of your state of health and other conditions.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that molds produce are mycotoxins, and mycotoxins are known to suppress the immune system.
Right.
So if you have a patient with an implant, and then on top of that, these implants carry molds which produce mycotoxins, well, then you've got a real toxic soup because it'll suppress their immune system, and that's in order so that the mold can invade you better.
Right.
But it also allows these other chemicals to affect you in a much more severe manner.
Yeah, and I've seen women with breast implants, sometimes just after getting them, they may be a little bit more susceptible than getting into moldy situations, sleeping on moldy mattresses after hurricanes, breathing air that's contaminated in scuba equipment, going into beach houses that are on just the environment, Florida, that, other beaches are moldy. And they breathe the mold in, and they don't realize that the mold can travel from the lung and the sinuses into the bloodstream and land on any implant. In fact, I think it probably does that very well.
Oh, yes. Oh, it can do. It travels very easily through the blood, and it's known to even cross the blood-brain barrier. So, in other words, it can go anywhere it wants, lungs, tissues, liver, kidneys, intestinal tract, and anywhere it really wants to. And that's another part of this problem with molds, is that there's no limit to what organs they can affect.
Okay.
And that's why a lot of these patients have so many problems that they go from doctor to doctor.
The doctors
do not recognize it. They don't know. They don't have the time to read about these things. They basically try to treat them, run the usual standard laboratory battery of tests, which show that, okay, yes, they're not diabetic, they don't have severe this or severe that, but really it's a generic test. And then they're shunted off as psychiatric people, people who, you need to go see a psychiatrist, it's all in your head. Well, of course, these women are depressed because they've spent a lot of time and money and everything else going from doctor to doctor, but they're also depressed because they feel terrible. And
well,
they feel
sick. Yeah, I've actually had candidiasis pretty severe, and I believe it does produce a depression that is different than a regular depression. A regular depression, you know, it affects certain things that the doctors ask about, but with the candidiasis depression, you just wake up feeling horrible. You wake up feeling poisoned is what it is. It's probably from the aldehydes and other mycotoxins. And it's not that you would plan to commit suicide because you don't have that ideation, but you just wish you wouldn't wake up, because you feel so bad when you wake up. When you get up and get going, you feel a little bit better. But I had an interesting story back when I was a resident. I was actually through medical school. I had a series of bladder infections and took a bunch of antibiotics. And, of course, I was exhausted because I was in surgery residency. And I got really bad candida- diocese, and so I was praying for an answer because I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I came across the issue of Omni Magazine. Do you remember Omni Magazine?
Yes, of course.
Omni Magazine had an article in it about yeast and that you could treat it with a drug called nystatin. Well, I got some, and within a week I was totally normal.
Yeah.
So it was just like this really amazing change from being, you know, hardly able to drag yourself around, and during a surgery residency, that's not a good thing, to being normal in a week because of a drug, and it was great. But it, that was the beginning of me understanding I had the genetic propensity for this.
Yes. And a group of us published a chapter in a medical textbook on the neurological and neurotoxic effects of molds and mycotoxins. And, of course, many patients have this a different type of depression, and that's because, again, this mold and mycotoxin can affect your brain, and mm-hmm. does. And when it gets to that point, you have a lot of anxiety as well as depression. Some people become extremely anxious. Of course, then they're put on some sort of drug by their physician, which really doesn't solve anything. It just
GABA,
makes it opaque.
Right, it's a GABA deficiency, and we give people GABA, and a lot of doctors actually prescribe Klonopin, and the patients do feel better on that because it's a GABA deficiency. But they're so thankful when I tell them that that anxiety disorder is you know, due to neurotransmitter problems, not necessarily due to psychological problems. Because I've had college professors and women who are extremely left-brained and logical have extreme anxiety, and they never had in their life. They're not, you know, they're not. They don't have a tendency to that at all because of who they are. So it is true. It's very, very common. And women also get brain lesions that look like MS. It's from myelin protein antibodies. And these lesions show up kind of like as white lesions. And some of my patients are in wheelchairs. They come in their 20s in wheelchairs, can't even walk. Severe neurological disease. It's funny, they come in with a diagnosis of lupus and MS, and actually they have neither. They have infected saline breast implants. And then within a week of me getting their implants out and getting them on antifungals, they're up walking, they're playing cards, they're talking on their, you know, they're able to dial their cell phone, and, you know, they're much better. Of course, when they get that bad, the road to recovery is a little bit longer than just the standard.
Correct. It is. I've seen it many times that where we have a patient come in and someone in the family told them to come in because they were diagnosed with MS, and this is a young mother with children to raise, and she's already made out her will and so on because that's what she was told, and they tried her on various MS-type drugs, et cetera, none of which really helped much, and then you examine them, diagnose them correctly, and tell them, no, you don't have MS. As a matter of fact, your condition is treatable.
Right.
And not only treatable, it's reversible. You will get better.
Yeah.
And that is a huge relief for a lot of these.
One of my patients was actually an MS neurologist. And he was there for a procedure, and I was running late, so I just threw him the book Mold Warriors by Richie Shoemaker and said, here, read this. I think some of your patients may have it. And so I was, you know, trying to get through some patients to get back to his surgery, and he goes, oh my God, I've got some patients with this disease. And then he sent them to me. It was really funny. He said, I knew they didn't have MS, but I didn't know what they had. Isn't that interesting?
Right, exactly.
He's like a really, really smart, you know, I mean, really good, and they don't know, just like you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think there's, I mean, I interviewed Richie Shoemaker, and he said there's just a lot of suppression of this. You know, there's just, in the medical field and in the political field, just suppression of research and suppression of, you know, physicians that are interested in this. And,
well, they certainly don't like any doctor that publishes in this field. I can tell you that one doctor who did a lot of research, he's a PhD, head of a department of microbiology, and chairman of the Department of Microbiology at a major medical school.
Mm-hmm.
His all the funding for his lab went to zero because he published some of his findings about molds and mycotoxins. So there's a lot of money involved in suppressing any information about molds and mycotoxins. Interestingly, however, the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, recognizes molds and mycotoxins because they continually make newer drugs, better and improved versions, et cetera, of antifungal medication.
And thank God, because molds get resistant to antifungals pretty easily, almost, I think, easier than antibiotics and bacteria. We have to keep switching them around, you know. So that's kind of good that they keep coming up with new ones. Do you think that the resistance, especially at a funding and maybe even governmental level, is primarily because of liability issues in buildings and workman's comp and, you know, home insurance, commercial
Well, I think
insurance?
If you look at the big picture, the answer is yes, because if we were to just look at schools, remember, schools are built by those who gave the lowest bid.
And, right.
notorious for having all kinds of leakage and so on and so forth, then that's where our children go to school.
Right.
What parents want their child to be exposed to any kind of problem? None. And here's one big potential liability, and that is that would cost the government huge amounts of money to repair these shoddily built buildings that are called schools. Then there's obviously, the issues of apartment buildings, which also are built very quickly and fast. And many times they're built by people from other countries who have emigrated here who are not familiar with these types of materials. And
right.
so they're, but, you know, the supervisor comes on Friday, gives them their paycheck, and they go about their business building these apartments. So that's another liability. And lastly, there's homes. And home builders have lately become very powerful because they've consolidated themselves. And they're all over the United States. You know, there's entire neighborhoods or suburbs built around certain builders.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, again, they try to do a good job and everything, and it's good to have homes. However, the buildings are not built that well, or the homes aren't, and I've had patients who are architects who live in a home, and their home, which they bought from a builder, and the home leaked. I have people who are higher up in the economic ladder, and they had a 10,000 square foot home built, custom built home. And yet, with the first rains, it leaked, and they had to move out for 6 months while the home was repaired from
and
the leak.
And it's hard to repair it. It really is. It's hard to get people out once it's in certain areas.
And that's people with economic
well.
Means. So, you know, what do people who don't have the means, the know-how, et cetera, what do they do? So, yes, it's a huge liability issue for the country, and, you know, we tend to ignore it. What they do in Europe, interestingly, and I'm half European, I'm half Swiss, my mother's Swiss, and my brother is an architect in Switzerland, and what they do there is if there's a problem like this, the engineers, architects, government employees, doctors, and all that get together to try to come up with a solution. However, here, if we tried to do that, it would be who's going to sue whom,
right.
And that's where one of the problems, the liability problem, comes into play, as you mentioned it before.
Yeah,
so there is no easy solution for this on the horizon for the United States, at least.
Yeah, I had foam board in my house that got wet, carpenter ants and termites, as well as mold, and So I went through that, tearing that out, and rebuilding it. Interesting, very expensive, not covered by insurance.
Yeah.
So, and this is, you know, this is an upscale house. It's a custom, you know, custom house, not a, you know, not a cookie cutter house. In fact, the contractor that did this whole neighborhood thought this was his house. So, like you say, they didn't know. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't have used this stuff if he'd known.
I was invited to speak to the American Institute of Architects at their annual meeting in San Antonio, where you went to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke with a group of them before the lecture and asked them what can they do to help this problem. Well, in the United States, apparently, anyone can get a building permit. In other words, you and I can tromp down on Monday to City Hall and get a permit. Whereas in most other countries, even in Mexico, just south of us, or Canada, just north of us, if you're going to build anything, you have to have an architect sign off on it, because architects are licensed.
Right.
And their license comes into danger, comes under scrutiny and danger if they don't build it correctly. Well, here we don't have that.
Mm.
Anyone can build a home.
That's
including you and me.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's very true. I didn't realize that. So now we've learned that regular drywall is probably not the best thing to put in houses. That I think they've got some better material that's more mold resistant. Do you know if that's being used widespread now, or is it just in some cases?
No, drywall is very easy to manufacture. And is not expensive. So therefore, it's unlikely that we will stop using drywall. However, it's also, if you gave mold a choice of what it would want to grow on, it could, and it could tell you, they would vote, molds would vote for drywall, because it is rich in what they're looking for. And a lot of patients ask me this question, Dr. Campbell, why is it now that we're having this problem? Why didn't we have this problem, I don't know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, et cetera? Well, back then, homes were built differently. They were built more solidly. And second,
with wood.
They used plaster. And plaster is very alkaline. So nothing grows on plaster. And then everything was open. You know, if you went to visit Grandma on Sunday, she had all the windows open. And anything that flew in flew back out. Well, today we have air conditioning, and the air conditioning is on all the time. And if it's not the air conditioning, it's the heating. So we don't breathe this fresh air anymore.
I mean, the air conditioning system is what gets infested with mold, because the water doesn't drain properly.
Yes. And these are issues that don't happen as much in other countries, because if you ever travel, you will know that throughout Europe and South America, et cetera, people open their windows all the time.
Right.
And people have a tendency to use the air conditioner only when it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
Or the heater when it's absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's open the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another issue that affects us, because we don't do that, so our houses have the same air circulating and circulating again and again and again,
right,
which is not that healthy.
Yeah, any mold in any little area, a little roof leak or whatever, circulates all over the house. I know I had had some revisions to my house, and they decided to put the dryer vent out a different place for good reason. You know, it was a safety issue. But they didn't seal it quite right, and so there was a water leak where they put it out. And I figured it out because my leg started to go numb. My thigh went numb, just on one side. It's very interesting. And it was only at night when I was sleeping in the upstairs bedroom. And so something kind of pushed me to look in a certain closet, and sure enough, there was a ring of water below where this dryer vent had come out on the roof. And that was causing, when I cleared that up, then the numbness of my leg went away. And that's really weird, you know. I mean, how many doctors would think that, you know, a patient coming in complaining of numbness of a thigh would be due to a water leak? And why wasn't it on both sides, you know? It's really weird. But it was true. I mean, it was, when I cleared that up, the numbness went away and didn't come back.
Yes, and you know, there's this, in the news, there's this these girls up in New York, upstate New York, at a school who have been recently diagnosed as having mass hysteria. Well, I remember maybe 10 years ago or a little more, a group of people came to see me that were actually working in a state government office.
Mm-hmm.
That was being housed in an old mall that was no longer in use as a mall, but they leased parts of the mall out. And the place leaked so bad that on the weekends, where they expected rain, they would have to cover the computers, printers, etc., with something because it would always leak.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they developed what could be called mass hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't quite as bad as what these young girls are exhibiting, but I would wonder very much if this these events happening in upstate New York with these young girls could be due to molds. Mm-hmm. And of course, schools we know are very leaky,
right,
and are known to do that. So,
well, especially in a certain area where you may have a genetic predisposition in the population, you know, if it's a homogeneous population.
Mm-hmm.
I think certain, there's definite genetic predispositions in mold disease, but if I would suspect that if you really had a severe neurotransmitter deficiency, that hysteria could result. I mean, it makes sense. Because of inhibitory, you know, signals wouldn't be there, and it would just build and build and build, and it would look like hysteria. All it is extreme anxiety.
And I, right now, I'm not very, I don't think the diagnosis of mass hysteria is an accurate diagnosis. They might be,
no.
they might be exhibiting that, but that's not the diagnosis. It's not the cause.
No. It's very interesting, but I had interviewed one of the pediatricians who was a toxicologist. She had a book. You probably know who I mean. I'm blanking on her name right now. But in the book, she had examples of handwriting that the children had under the influence of biotoxins from mold, and then when they were cleared up. And then she had pictures of them. And one of them, they look like demon children because they have dark circles under their eyes, and they're like really, they're really angry looking, and they have eyes that are piercing, and that's the mold effect. And then when they don't have mold, they look like normal children. It's just really amazing.
Well, there's actually two books. One is by Dr. Kay Kilburn, who did a study and shows the handwriting and all those kind of things. And the other is Dr. Doris Rapp.
Yeah, with Dr. Doris Rapp, I had one.
Dr. Kilburn's book is Endangered Brains.
Really? Okay.
And is the title of his book. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Doris Rapp, who I'm sure you've met, she's a wonderful lady. I mean, she showed, she videotapes a lot of this because people don't believe it.
No, it's
and,
so amazing.
Of course, conventional medicine doesn't believe it, and then when you show them the video, they say the video's been
altered.
altered.
Or fake.
And Dr. Rapp wouldn't know how to alter a video.
Yeah, right.
Or anything like that, bless her heart. You know, it's just this attitude of disbelief because, you know, which is
shocking.
Well, they
don't understand toxicology. I think it goes back that we have a very bad problem in not educating doctors about toxic chemicals, mold toxins, you know, aflatoxins causing cancer. You know, they don't know these things because they're not taught. It's in the medical literature. I mean, you know, all of the toxins have been studied by PhDs, maybe not extensively because they don't get funded, but they've been identified. So probably there's more toxins out there than what is just in the literature. I mean, how hard is it to believe that toxins cause problems? That's why they're called toxins.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that you hit the nail on the head with that, with what you just said. The studies are there. There are textbooks, there are articles, and there's not, you know, a dozen. There's hundreds of them.
There's a book on biofilms, for God's sake. I mean, biofilms are now a new concept in biology that if you have a foreign material, or even not a foreign material, like in the sinuses, you can get a film of all sorts of creatures that cooperate with each other, set up communications, and have a small city that you can't kill with antifungals and antibiotics, you know, because they're too smart. They figured out how to get it not, you know, to set up barriers so that it doesn't get in.
I am readily amazed by how much is out there and how little doctors, your conventional doctors, use it. I don't know if you know this or not, but I'm the editor-in-chief of two peer-reviewed medical journals, and they're both indexed. And I get submission of articles from all over the world. And initially, when I first started this, when I was first offered this position and I looked at that, I was surprised to see how much in other countries this is well-studied, well-read. Doctors know about it. They publish about it all the time. Whereas in our medical literature, it's basically not looked at very much and unknown.
Right.
Published, but not much is done about it.
I don't think doctors want to know about it. I think it affects their bottom line or makes them have to practice a type of medicine that's much more difficult. I know when I go into a room with a patient who's deathly ill, I have to figure out what kind of toxicity they have. I have to figure out, you know, how to treat it. And then one thing we haven't talked about is when your immune system goes down because of these mycotoxins, then you have to look for viral diseases, you have to look for intracellular bacteria like mycoplasma, spirochetes, and all those diseases that aren't studied because they're the basis of our biological warfare system. And I know that because I was in the military. And basically, you know, you got to figure out what's wrong with them, and there could be like four or five things wrong with them causing these, and they all cause similar symptoms, and you got to figure it out, because if you don't figure out the cause, you're not going to be able to treat them. And that's just a concept regular doctors don't get. You don't treat symptoms. I mean, just to treat them. That's ridiculous. You'll never get the cause. Yeah, the patient may feel better, but they're going to die of some sort of, you know, complication of something you missed.
Which is very unfortunate, because I think that statement is very accurate. In the United States, we never treat the cause. We constantly treat the symptom. And, oh, you have a headache, here's a pill. You don't feel good, here, take an antidepressant.
Right.
You still don't feel good, take a stronger dose. It's never
now you're on eight
really
medications.
Wrong with the patient. I was at a conference in Europe, and one of our colleagues said, "In America, you treat every symptom with a pill."
Right, and then the pills interact with each other, and
yes.
That leads to the Dr. Shealy, who I interviewed the other day, said that it's going up, but there was a paper published that the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. is correct use of prescription medication.
Yes.
I mean, not overdose, not someone who takes a handful
That's
of
right.
sleeping pills or takes their medicine wrong. They're taking it correctly.
That's right. That's right.
So I remember in the military, this is funny, when we had somebody who was deathly ill and we didn't know what was wrong with them, we just took them off all their medicine. I mean, it was just something that the residents taught down, you know. And we do it, and then all of a sudden they get better.
Yeah.
If you're in the military, you can do a lot of stuff. It's funny. I don't think you could get away with that in a regular residency program.
No, probably not.
Yeah.
Probably some attending would be...
No, you can't do that because they're being paid by the company to give lectures. And, you know.
That's right. the military, as you, you know, I know you know this, but the military has weaponized, as they call it, mycotoxins. We used it in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It was known as Yellow Rain, not
right.
Agent Orange. Agent Orange is the defoliant.
Right.
This was known as Yellow Rain. There were approximately 400 sorties flown, and the tally was that of about 10,000 enemy dead because of this.
Mm-hmm.
Saddam Hussein used it in his Scud missile warheads.
Mm-hmm.
So mycotoxins are known to be lethal
deadly.
And deadly by the, government,
yeah.
by the military.
Right. They really are. One of the tests that I use that is very good is called the visual contrast sensitivity test. And it's very easy. You just buy a little thing with an eye chart on it. And not a traditional eye chart. It's a special eye chart. And you give it to the patient at a certain distance, and they either can tell which way the lines are going or can't tell. And if somebody has mold in one breast implant, say the left side, the left eye test is abnormal, but the right side is normal, because the neurotoxin tends to stay on the same side, which is very interesting. But the guy that developed this test emailed me because he had no idea that you could use this test that way. Because it was used for something else. I mean, he developed it for something else. But that just shows you the degree to which affecting the optic nerve, mold exposure, even before it really makes somebody really sick, will affect the nerves, and it can be measured if you want to do it.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. I am not familiar with this test.
I'll be happy to give you some information on it. It's called a visual contrast sensitivity test. You can order it. I think it's like about $50 for the device. I mean, it's really cheap. And then you have to get a meter, distance meter or something with it, too. I think it might come with it. And it's easy to perform. You can teach your staff to do it. And, I use it a lot because I want to know, if somebody comes in with mold disease and doesn't have mold in their environment, and we can test for that with mold plates. You know, you're real familiar with how to do that.
Yeah.
It's in their body. So I want to find out what side it's on. And as you know, mold doesn't always cause chest wall symptoms. So especially, it will later because it'll lower the immune system enough, and they'll get infected, and they'll get pain from that. But at first, it doesn't. So they have fibromyalgia pretty bad. And that's funny because regular doctors say we don't know what causes fibromyalgia, but we really do. But anyway, they have fibromyalgia, and they think it might be their breast implants because they went online. Not because their doctor told them, because they went online and read about it on the board. So they come in, and I do the visual contrast sensitivity, and one eye is really abnormal and the other is normal, so I know that that's infected. So I do the other side first, you see, because I don't want to transfer mold from the bad chest wall to the good chest wall. And then sometimes we don't always, because it costs extra money and insurance doesn't cover it. We'll send it into Micromatrix and they'll find mold in the implant. If only mold is around the implant in the capsule, it's much harder to find. I've worked with researchers to do DNA typing and everything, and it's just if it's not growing in the implant, it seems to be a lot harder to isolate. Probably because we've got the patients on antifungals and especially on antifungals prior to surgery. I put almost everybody on antifungals, so even if they were growing something, the researchers tell me the antifungals would mess with what they're doing, so they can't grow it out.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with a gentleman in Canada by the name of Dr. Pierre Blay.
Oh, yeah, very, very familiar.
Yeah. He was one of the first people, a PhD scientist, who analyzed breast implants once they were removed.
Mm-hmm.
And he also sounded the alarm, again, way back in the early 90s about these implants containing mold and the dangers due to platinum and so on and so forth. And very, very thorough scientist. Unfortunately, he's in Canada, not here. Otherwise, I'm sure that people would have used him a lot more.
Right.
But yeah, his studies
show some women send their implants in to look for valve defects, you know, in the saline implant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then he was doing analysis of the shell leaking in silicone, too. Because you can tell, I mean, you can look up the specific gravity of silicone, and then you can weigh your implant that comes out of your body, and you can figure out how much should have been in there versus how much is in there, and that's how much leaked out into your body. I mean, you can do it. It's doable. And almost all implants leak after about, I think they start leaking after about 6 years, to tell you the truth. And some leak immediately. There's some back plates that leak immediately. And I know that
I've
because
seen.
One of the reps told me to put the other rep's implant on a paper towel for a week, and sure enough, there was a ring of silicone.
Yeah.
Around the back plate. So
it leaves an oily circle.
Right, yeah. You can prove it to yourself. But it's amazing the amount of ostrich technique the medical profession uses so it doesn't have to look at data it doesn't want to look at. It's just amazing.
And for how long did they say, oh, no, implants are completely safe?
Completely safe, yeah. Even the one, I mean, no foreign body is completely safe. Anybody who actually paid attention in medical school and residency would know that. I mean, foreign material is fraught with danger. We know that from just everything that we put in the body. Not that you can't take precautions. I mean, I have saline implants, so I've had them. I had silicone that leaked, and I got saline, and they leaked and got moldy, and I got newer ones. And you have to keep changing them out, and you have to treat with the correct antifungals, and you have to, you know, be very careful if you have a bacteremia. It can definitely settle on an implant. I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying you can do it. I mean, you know, it's possible. But women aren't told these things. They aren't told that when they get their teeth cleaned, they might ought to take an antibiotic, you know, or an antifungal, or whatever. So, what are the names of the journals, again, that you're an editor of?
The two journals are, one is Advances in Mind-Body Medicine,
mm-hmm.
and the other is Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine.
I've read the Alternative Therapies articles. Well, that's great. That's great. Are you seeing any increase in physicians, especially the integrative physicians in the U.S., which is definitely a growing population? Are you seeing an increase in these physicians knowing about chemical toxicity and biotoxicity?
Oh, absolutely. There isn't a conference that deals with integrative medicine that does not have issues about toxicity, chemicals, and the way these chemicals cause disease, which is a nice change from just the usual symptom-oriented kind of conferences. These are very intense. They're very good. These doctors throughout the country.
Yeah.
Integrative medicine is basically taking your conventional medicine and mixing in alternative and using the best of both.
Yeah, and it's functional medicine too, which I love, because functional medicine really shows which pathways are working, which aren't. A lot of nutrient deficiency affect pathways. A lot of toxins affect pathways, and I think it's the most intelligent way to practice medicine. You look at everything and you see what's working, what's not working. Change what you can change, which is exposure to toxins, and you know, add nutrients and supplements that allow the person to go toward greater health.
And functional medicine turned 20 years old. So
really,
it's been Dr. Jeffrey Bland,
right?
Who's the founder of that?
Mm-hmm.
at the annual conference, I believe that was at the end of April of last year, was honored for his, well, bringing all this wonderful new way of diagnosing and coming to a conclusion and helping patients who have very complex problems. And they showed case at that conference, which was several days long, case after case after case. I remember in particular this one woman came in to see them. She had severe rheumatoid arthritis, was on prednisone and various other drugs, was obese, had developed diabetes as a result of the prednisone. Her cholesterol was sky high.
Right.
And 1.5 years after them weaning her off first all these drugs and then building her back up, she was of normal weight and on no medications and healthy.
Yeah.
So that's...
Well, you restore the immune system so it can fight the, you know, the autoimmune disease, then, you know.
Exactly.
It really helps. I had interviewed on this radio show Michael Murray, What in the World Are They Spraying? And, in fact, we're going to have him back for Why in the World Are They Spraying? That's the second DVD he did. But I've noticed, because we do, you know, hair analysis here to look at what people have, baseline heavy metal toxicity. I've noticed a lot more barium and a lot more of the chemicals that he says are being sprayed in the patients that we're doing hair analysis on. Do you have any insights into getting these chemicals out of people? Because they're not good for them. I don't think they're good for them at all. Droney,
well, I think one of the challenges we all have when we're exposed to these chemicals is how we expose to them. You know, there's absorption through the skin, there's inhalation, and you ingest them. You ingest them because you have a cup of tea sitting next to you and it gets on the tea and you drink your tea down. One is to look at the ingestion. Second is to look at the, not the ingestion, the how it was absorbed. Second, what was the condition of the patient's immune system when this happened? Because if you line up 10 people, same age, same height, same weight, they'll all get affected differently by the same substance.
Yeah,
so,
and that's a part of functional medicine, to be able to measure the degree to which people can get rid of toxins, because we're all exposed, unless maybe you live in the Himalayan somewhere. Even then, I'm not sure you're not exposed to something.
Oh, yeah, correct. And these exposures, how do you deal with the exposure once they're there? You know, how do they affect you? Well, one person's going to have neurological symptoms and effects, and other person is going to have gastrointestinal, other are going to have respiratory issues. And again, yes, you have to help the symptoms, but you also have to do something regarding the getting rid of this and getting it out of the body, detoxifying the patient. And the number one thing that has been found to work the best is if that is... strengthen the immune system first. Get that up, and it'll then you'll have an ally, meaning the immune system, in getting rid of this substance from your system.
Right. I found a combination for myself recently that worked very well. You know, I kind of described a little bit about, I probably have difficulty getting rid of toxins, especially biotoxins, and get fibromyalgia symptoms from that. That lowers the immune system, and then you get viruses. So I stayed sick a lot with viruses because, of course, I get exposed to them. I found that a combination of liposomal GSH and liposomal vitamin C, ever since I've been on that, I haven't been sick with anything. So I'd highly recommend vitamin C, antiviral, probably anti-cancer, and then glutathione. The liposomal is well-absorbed, they say, as well as the IV. And that's to help get rid of the chemical toxins, which I know I have.
Well, I think that those, and I would also mention alpha-lipoic acid, because those are all very potent antioxidants.
Right, yeah.
And those help get rid of the toxins that you're carrying, that a person is carrying around. I think
we just
that,
have a, We just have a few more minutes. I want to ask you to comment on respiratory symptoms from mold exposure, because that's a lot more common than just the estimated 25% of the population that can't get rid of the biotoxins. I mean, most people in a real moldy area will have some sort of respiratory problems if chronically exposed.
Well, it's one of the major parts that that can be where it can affect you is the lungs, because you inhale these spores, and these spores are so tiny that they get down into the deepest parts of the lungs, and then not only do they cause an inflammatory reaction in the lungs, but they're also absorbed through the alveoli into the bloodstream. So that's the local reaction, which is an inflammatory reaction, and what happens? You get cough, you get wheezing, you get asthma, shortness of breath,
sinus
and
problems.
All these type of pulmonary symptoms, and of course, the usual anti-asthma stuff doesn't help. I mean, it may help some of the symptoms, and you may have to use an inhaler or something like that, but really what the patients need is the antifungals, you well know. The other aspect of it going into the lung, again, is that it gets absorbed through the bloodstream and then goes elsewhere. But if you really, really take a very careful history, most of the time you'll find that the lungs was the first thing affected, or the brain.
Right.
Because once it gets into the lung, it takes 7 seconds for that to reach the brain.
Right.
And patients will start telling you that, you know, they have short-term memory loss, they get disoriented easily, they're driving along and they don't know all of a sudden where they are, although it's a street they've been on 100 times before. They can't remember people's names, telephone numbers that they've dialed hundreds of times they can't remember, et cetera, et cetera. And they start deteriorating mentally. And again, into the lungs, from the lungs to the brain, and causing these neurological
issues. I wonder how many
Alzheimer's
patients really have mold exposure. You know, wrong diagnosis.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that certainly it bears looking into. Although I don't know of anyone that's given an antifungal to an Alzheimer patient to see if that would be helpful, but that would be an interesting thing to do.
Yeah. Well, if there's evidence of mold exposure, you could do a visual contrast sensitivity. That tends to be really, really specific for this. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
A fair number of people without any symptoms also have, the visual contrast affected, that do have reason to have mold, you know, because they've been on antibiotics long-term or something. But like I said, they've got the bodies that can get rid of the biotoxin. But I think I think you're right, the nerves are affected first, and people don't realize it. It's not at a level that they even recognize sometimes, unless it's bad enough to do what you just said. Well, we're coming to the end of the hour. Is there any contact information you'd like to give for yourself or the journals that you edit?
Yeah, the two journals, Advances in Mind-Body Medicine. The first one, the second one, is Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. And it has my contact information in either journal. Both journals are indexed, meaning they're in the National Library of Medicine. They're good journals for this kind of these kind of problems that most doctors don't look at, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I think patients need to get on the Internet and do their own research. The symptoms and the stories are on the Internet. There are support groups and lists of doctors that understand functional medicine and mold and other toxins in our world. But our epidemic ADHD, our epidemic chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and you have to laugh that now the pharmaceutical industry has a drug to treat fibromyalgia. I think that's just hilarious. And all of the other mystery diseases out there are not mystery diseases. They're diseases of an extremely toxic and ignorant society that where the medical profession, often while causing these diseases, is putting its head in the sand as to what they are and suppressing research. So that's just not good. And hopefully all of that will change. I think the rise in young doctors who are smarter than their predecessors were and can understand the complexity of functional medicine and help, you know, weed it out and figure out really what's going on with the patient is interesting. You know, with House, probably watched House and almost every other episode, they're going into somebody's house to look for toxins and molds.
Yes.
It's interesting. That's never really done, is it? I mean,
no.
I've never seen that done.
No, not anymore, unfortunately.
No. But they do it. You know, they come out with all this mold and, you know, all these other things that might have caused the illness. So when you got when you have a mystery disease, think about what we talked about today.
That's right.
Get to someone who knows what they're doing, because it could be even fatal. A lot of these chemicals and a lot of these mycotoxins are, cancer causing. So could be a problem. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. It was a great, great educational discussion. And,
well, thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me.
Oh, great. We'll have to do it again.
We sure will.
All righty. Take care now.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the weekend, Dr. Cole.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We have Noetic Science the third Thursday in February. I am embarrassed to say I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I believe it's the producers of Frequency of Genius, which is a DVD with really good interviews with a number of scientists and experts in the fields we're talking about today, as well as some other topics that are critical for us, for our society to survive. We have Stanton Friedman back, a nuclear physicist, talking about flying saucers in science next week. And then on the 4th of February, Helene Adrian is discussing On Fertile Ground, Healing Infertility. And Marie Jones is coming back on the 11th, Destiny versus Choice, the Scientific and Spiritual Evidence Behind Fate and Free Will. That's one of the very interesting questions that, in metaphysics, that I'm anxious to read her book on, because I think that that's a very important question. Anyway, this is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been talking with Dr. Andrew Campbell on toxic mold, one of the leading national experts on that subject. And join us next week. Have a great week.